throat. I've got a cough drop, so we'll make it. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the chair has a bit of a cold. I would like Senate Bill 555 in another room. If we could do it downstairs on Friday at 1, I think we'd be more comfortable.
It is at 1, not at 3.
It's at 1.
Good.
And
I'll go talk now. This is okay.
Okay. We're going to begin with a public hearing on Senate Bill 1229. We should have a quorum shortly. I just came from Ways and Means, and most committees are still going, so that's why two of our other members aren't here. I would request John Rachel?
Rachel.
And Bill?
No, seriously?
Oh, no. No. This is Reichelblum?
I'm John Reichelblum. This is Bill Reichelblum.
Dave Lingborg here. Paul's County Sheriff.
Long name I tried to read.
Well, you said John.
There's a John and a Bill. They are both in trouble for their penmanship. But we'll see how Bill does.
Ready for it to begin?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for this opportunity to come up here and speak before you. I'm John Reichel, Clinton County Sheriff, and I'm before you today as the Chair for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Marine Affairs Committee. Senate Bill 1229, the Sheriff of Oregon supports. The issue here is one of two things. It's one of making existing laws more effective because it'll require coordination by the State Marine Board for record keeping of the bills of stolen boats, not the bills, but the reports of stolen boats, which establishes a central repository for us to run checks through, and also establishes a crime of false reporting of a theft of a boat. This currently exists for all other motor vehicles except for boats, and we do not believe that the fiscal impact is very significant to any agency. In fact, we think that the efficiency created by this would overweigh any additional cost it would bring.
And you're going to tell legislative fiscal that? Because we got a surprise today on the legislative impact.
Please. Senator Bryant, and other senators, I'm from the State Marine Board. My name is Bill or William Reedbloom. I represent the Marine Law Enforcement Program. I'd like to offer testimony prepared by Board Director Paul Don Hefner. State Marine Board is in full support of Senate Bill 1229. We work closely with the Oregon Sheriff's Association, in particular John Reichel of the Marine Affairs Committee, in developing this bill. This bill establishes a record-keeping requirement for boat theft reports. It also creates the crime of filing a false or fraudulent report or theft of boat. Because of lack of adequate reporting of boat thefts, we really can't pinpoint the exact magnitude of the marine theft problem in Oregon, although we expect it to be in the low hundreds, possibly as many as 500 a year. However, based on the data we do have and reports from the field officers, we believe the problem is significant, it is increasing, and needs further attention, and that is why we recommend passage of this bill. We need to establish record-keeping requirements for boat theft reports within this state. Currently, the Marine Board receives only a small fraction of the stolen boats report from local law enforcement agencies, and there's no requirement to forward these reports to our board. As the agency responsible for titling and registering of boats, the lack of reporting can cause us to reissue a title or registration to a new owner, not knowing if the boat has been reported stolen. The Law Enforcement Data System, or LEDS, does not maintain a database of stolen boats, and the board can't obtain access to the NCIC system. This bill would require law enforcement agencies to report stolen and recovered stolen boats to the State Marine Board. If a boat reported as stolen is identified during the registration process, the Marine Board shall discontinue processing and notify the law enforcement agency that initiated the theft report. And it would create a crime for filing false or fraudulent reports to police agencies. Both thieves create a paper trail on boats that don't even exist. They file a stolen boat report to law enforcement and then file a claim with their insurance company. So this bill would clearly make it a crime with regard to boat theft. Reports from the field indicate that a number of Oregon counties are finding more stolen boats as a result of more rigorous training and inspection of hull identification numbers in the field. We believe the problem is significant, is increasing, and needs further attention, which is why we recommend passage.
Mr. General, the difference between this bill and current law was the deal of filing a false police report.
Help me with that, John.
The false police report is where we have an issue with the motor vehicle ones on false police reports where the person has to sign acknowledgement of it, and that makes them also at that point responsible for any of the recovery costs. That does not exist currently for the marine-related boats and boat trailers. But boat trailers are maybe registered and titled by DMV, and that at that point it was the smaller boat trailers are not. As far as still filing a false police report, we can still pursue that, but it's not an individual classified law.
Okay. John, is boat defined in the current statutes? Do you have boat defined someplace in state law?
It is defined as vessels, and it gives a description of vessels and the classifications by whether they're motorized, sail, or otherwise.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
And all boats have to be licensed through State Marine Board?
Almost all boats. All motorized and sailboats 12 feet and longer.
Okay.
Canoes, kayaks, inflatables, non-motorized, small boats don't have to be.
See, one more shipment. John, you wouldn't, law enforcement wouldn't be required, or they wouldn't necessarily report to LEDs, would they, on the theft of a boat?
That's correct. We would report to LEDs those that fall in the classification for either the monetary value or that have the identification numbers available. We have no other requirement to report them, and there's no requirement to report to the Marine Board. This way, even if we cannot establish a HIN number, a hull identification number, we still have to give a descriptor to the Marine Board, and there will be a local suppository, or central suppository for the classification and description.
Okay, and the retrieval of that information is available during an 8-hour day, or what time frame, John? How can you access the information to the State Marine Board on a possible recovery?
Sharon, Senator Carno, we can access the Marine Board records by computer through LEDs at any time.
Okay.
And otherwise, they'll be through the business hours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 1229. Open the work session on Senate Bill 1229.
I move Senate Bill 1229. What? To the floor with a due pass recommendation, please.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 1229 the floor to pass. Discussion? You satisfied the role with objection? And then so on. Senator Duke would like to say that. Why don't we let her do that?
That's nice.
I'm going to open then the public hearing on Senate Bill 23 and Senate Bill 1247. Some of the testimony of people might want to testify on both at the same time. This is one that's not going to any work session today. The people that operate private prisons were not available today, and if you notice on our schedule for Monday at 4 o'clock, they will be available. So we'll bring back the bill for invited public testimony on Monday at 4, in addition to our other items. Committee, the Senator Q-Jub has particular interest in this, and of course studied in the interim and went to several national conventions discussing the pros and cons of private prisons. And some were sponsored by the NCSL. I don't know what the other groups were. My interest in this, so people understand, is although cost is a factor, that's not what's driving me, I think. It's basically the cost comparisons come out fairly equally. We might save a little money on the actual construction by a private prison, but I'm more interested in a few things. One, I don't think it's good to have a monopoly, so it's nice to have a different entity operate a prison so you can do a comparison. And I think that's good in any business or branch of government. Secondly, I'm interested in outcomes and comparing outcomes, and that's a discussion we haven't really had in Oregon about what outcomes should we expect from prisons. I serve on a committee with the National Institute of Justice, and we've had, 30 people from around the country. Some of them run prison systems in other states, and it was interesting to see or hear their discussion on what their responsibilities were. The head of the Virginia prison system said, my responsibility is to accept people, lock them up, and send them out when the sentence is over. The gentleman from Vermont said, no, I've got more of a responsibility and here to try and improve the situation and do what I can so they can return to the community and not commit new crimes. The lady from Missouri is real strong on education, and so she rewards and encourages education, and she's seen a drop in her recidivism rates because she makes GED and advanced studies almost a requirement of getting out. But what outcomes do we expect as we go through this? And I think that includes basic education, drug and alcohol treatment, improvement in cognitive skills, work skills, all those sorts of things, and then how do you measure them? And I've sent a letter to the National Institute of Justice, which, along with the federal prison programs, spend a lot of money on studies, and I'm hopeful that they might be interested in taking a look at developing a program that focuses on outcomes. The legislature would need to establish those outcomes, and then it's a longitudinal study of whether they're being met and how they're being met. And that would be interesting in comparison, then, too, between a private prison, and that private prison can be unionized. This isn't a union issue. I'd be an NLRB type union versus the state public employees type union. But I think it's important to have those comparisons. So those are my thoughts as we go through this. And as I said, the bills before us today aren't intended to be a perfect statement, but it brings the discussion to it. I included the Oregon Youth Authority in Senate Bill 23 because of that same type of discussion I think we should have concerning the Oregon Youth Authority. And it's not my intention to turn an existing prison or youth facility into a private. This is just for a future prisoner's night. And the same would be true of the Oregon Youth Authority, so I don't intend to disrupt the current employer-employment relationship that exists now. But Senator Cusub is still in Ways and Means and wanted to be here. But we're going to begin the discussion. And what I'm going to do then is...
Do I get to make a statement?
You may, please. Anyone who may make a statement.
Well, I sat through those public hearings. And just for the record, there were, I think, two or three conclusions that came to me that were very interesting. All the private prison operators, some of whom had these multinational types of companies, they had prisons not just in this country, they had them throughout the world. Unless they were just doing it for effect, somewhere, if not in the beginning, it's closely after the beginning of the opening statement, Mr. Chair, was a remarkable statement that the State of Oregon's Department of Correction was remarkably efficient, remarkably well run, and was a model. That wasn't one. That wasn't two. That was time and time and time again. Those aren't my words. You can go back and review the record of these individuals. Now, maybe they were hoping, therefore, they'd get the favorable bid if something went, if we go this route. Number two, which stunned me, I said, all right, if this idea is so great, let's just turn the entire Department of Corrections over to the private sector. They ran away from that statement so fast. One of the biggest Segunda guns who came to testify, this guy who was dressed as impeccable as it is, had just flown in his Learjet, ran the national, multinational company. He couldn't get away from that state as fast enough. No, no. I would never want to do that. Well, why don't you want to do that if you do that? No. Because we need Oregon's public prison system to make sure that there's a check on us, to learn from them, to make sure that we're doing a good job. That statement is in the record. The final statement is, and this one blew me away, okay, we want to run our joints. How about parole and probation? Oh, we don't need part of that. We don't want to touch parole and probation, which I found very, very interesting. You're getting from the tone of my voice that I am less than enamored. Plus, the final statement is that when we have used the private system outside, particularly with women prisoners, we've had some very nasty things happen in those systems. I'm well aware that Mr. Cook and company is willing to go for privatization. I don't know about Mr. Rick Hill and company for whatever reasons now, because maybe political pressure or not. But I want to make it very clear that an individual who sat through hours and reams of testimony, that it's interesting how much of a model Oregon is. And to quote from the great Governor Nicotia, if it ain't broke, then what the devil are we doing for our system? I realize you were expecting that kind of statement, but that's my statement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other comments?
Attached to the information today is a report issued by the Associated Marine Institute, and Mr. Taylor attended a conference, and Senator Gordler was there, that dealt with this particular type of a youth facility. It wasn't a lockup facility. It was been on television dealing with the Everglades and Florida County had Last Chance Swamp or something.
Last Chance Swamp.
Yeah.
I think Senator Brown was there.
It's a juvenile.
Juvenile Rights Project during the conference along with SCF, the local commissions and the ABA.
So why don't you just summarize? And this is a private approach. As I said, and it's not a lockdown facility per se, but you're in the Everglades in a swamp at night.
The chairman of the committee is going through this again and refreshing memory from the conference, I believe, which is well over a year ago. The Last Chance Ranch is run by the Associated Marine Institute, and they wonder about the name, but it was actually started as a result of a conversation between a judge and a local businessman in Florida, and they put this program together. And what struck my attention is that they take very hardcore kids. It's almost, when you go in, it's like a boot camp situation where they put them in basically the swamps of Florida. And if they do well there, then they move up to the next level where they have air conditioning and better amenities for living. But what they do is they have a strong sense of community. And then they get better benefits and they get education if they do well. If they don't, they're usually sent to the Florida Department of Corrections. I mean, these kids are in there for very serious crimes. What they also do is, after attending the program, each child is placed in school, a job, or the armed forces. And I'm reading from page 2, over 70% of the children that attend will never be convicted of a crime again. Those are pretty good statistics. Youth are monitored for 3 years after they graduate to offer assistance and to help the staff compile statistics on their successes.
Thank you. With that, we'll begin the testimony, and I'd invite Rich Peppers. And Rich, I understand you have 3 people with you. If you'd come forward, please, and I'm going to ask Courtney to chair for a moment. I'm going to go get a couple more comments.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rich Peppers with the Oregon Public Employees Union. We represent the employees of the Oregon Youth Authority. Much of what we'll be talking about is directed specifically at Senate Bill 23, but we think that a lot of what we'll be saying also applies to the other bill that's before you today. And it's no surprise to you that we're here opposing Senate Bill 23. The other people up here with me will introduce themselves as we go through the testimony. I'm just going to present a little bit of a overview of what we're going to be talking about, and much of what I was going to be saying has already been taken ahead of me by Senator Courtney, so I appreciate that. We will be talking in particular about we'll give an overview over the national privatization debate as it relates to youth corrections, and we have somebody here from Washington, D.C., who will provide that testimony to you. We'll also give you some direct testimony from people who work in OYA, and a number of people are here to talk about that, as well as talk about some of the risks entailed in going down this road of privatization, and we have some examples from other situations in other states of what happens when mistakes are made. We were unable to meet with the proponents of Senate Bill 23 because it was difficult to figure out exactly who that was, but we nonetheless are going to try and address the main reasons that are generally given for privatizing facilities, and those tend to fall into two categories. One is cost savings, and the other is organizational or political problems, structural issues, a loss of faith that an institution can be run effectively. In response to the second point first, we'd like to make the point that was just being made by Senator Courtney that the Oregon Youth Authority, since its inception in 1995, has had a strong emphasis on public safety as well as treatment of the juveniles that are incarcerated there. This treatment component is critical in the Oregon Youth Authority, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. And a key component for the Oregon Youth Authority is also its relationships to the rest of between the state and the county juvenile systems. Over the past 4 years, for instance, the Juvenile Justice Information System has connected a statewide network of juvenile directors, and this system is working. The key to the success of OYA is its staff and the quality of the staff. Aside from keeping dangerous juvenile offenders off the street, OYA offers a supervision model for rehabilitation. This model relies heavily on the success on the direct interaction with the juveniles by the staff. And the offenders are not locked up behind cell doors. There's open dorm sleeping and open day room. And in response to some of the comments that were made earlier by Senator Bryant, I'd like to point out that there's also a cottage system approach, which allows for different kinds of programs to be used and to be explored, and a competition, in a sense, between different programs and approaches to take place within OYA already today. OPEU members generally agree that the supervision model is difficult, but that breakthroughs with juveniles only become possible when reliable relationships have been established. And because of the importance of the staffing, training has been a focus for OYA and is an important investment. There, in my written testimony, you'll find some further elaboration on this, but there's also just a note here that over 1,000 years, just by a rough calculation, OYA frontline staff has over 1,000 years of experience in youth corrections totaled up. The importance of training is emphasized in some academic studies, too, are backed up by that, and those are cited in my written testimony. The relatively short history of OYA since its inception in 98 still is long enough to draw some conclusions. And I'd like to just give you the recidivism statistics, which for OYA have been declining since 92 on a steady decline, and are now approximately 30%, which is similar to a figure that was used earlier for adult corrections. The common argument of privatization proponents that are suggesting a way to overcome serious problems in an existing agency clearly does not apply in OYA's case. As Senator Courtney mentioned before, this agency isn't broken, and no attempt needs to be made to fix it. The cost argument we'll be elaborating on in a minute with further testimony and much more detailed testimony, but we just like to make the point here that we don't believe there's very much evidence that savings could be generated, and there's just as much, if not more, evidence that the opposite view is true. Before I turn over to the next speaker, let me just remind or sum up that to be successful, OIA needs the foundation of individual relationships. Training qualified staff to be effective at fostering these relationships and encouraging staff to stay around so continuity is assured are vital to OIA's mission. We believe privatizing an OIA facility could jeopardize this mission more broadly than just in the one particular facility in point. And we do not find that there is sufficient evidence of either organizational or administrative problems or of the potential for significant savings to warrant putting at risk what is currently a well-run agency that produces results for Oregon. And with that, I'll turn it over to our next speaker.
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Lisa Codispoti, and I am a senior research analyst with the Public Division of the Service Employees International Union based in Washington, D.C. And I'm pleased to be here today to have the chance to speak with you about Senate Bill 23. As a senior analyst working with our union members who are public sector employees, I spend the majority of my time dealing with many different issues of privatization, including prison privatization and the privatization of corrections. But as a former budget analyst with the New York State Assembly Ways and Means Committee, I can certainly understand why many state and local governments are tempted to turn to privatization in the hopes of achieving savings. However, as a researcher who has explored many problems that governments have encountered with many different types of privatization, I would like to share with you some reasons why the state of Oregon cannot afford to experiment not only with Oregon taxpayers' money, but that Oregon can't afford to experiment with the lives of its youth who will be placed in a private youth correctional facility. To briefly set the national stage for this discussion, currently less than 5% of all juvenile prisons are run by private companies. But even as the use of private youth and adult correctional facilities has grown over the years, states are now considering tightening their control over these operators, especially in the wake of quality problems. For example, the New York Times recently reported that three states, Ohio, Texas, and Tennessee, are currently considering legislation to enact tighter controls over private prisons. And even Congress is grappling with this very issue. A bill with bipartisan support has been introduced in the House of Representatives that would ban the future use of private prisons for federal inmates and ban states receiving certain types of federal grants from contracting with private prisons. Now, in the context of the discussion of this bill, there are two points that I would like to make. Now, as to the issue of whether there are savings to be had in private correctional facilities, the jury is basically still out. And then the second point that I'd like to make today is that regardless of the question of savings, given the number of quality problems that we've seen in private corrections, and especially in private youth corrections, it raises the suggestion that you often get what you pay for. And this is especially critical in the field of youth corrections, given the potential for these types of quality problems to ruin the lives of these youthful offenders. Now, several states have attempted to study the issue of whether private correctional facilities are less costly than state-operated facilities, and the results of these studies have been mixed. Now, the difficulties reaching an accurate comparison between the public and private facilities result from the fact that it is virtually impossible to have two identical facilities to review, ranging from the differences in the physical plant, which can impact on staffing patterns, to the security risks of the youth in the facility, to the medical needs of the population being served. And furthermore, in some cases, there have been allegations that private operators cream some of the inmates by taking inmates that are easier to treat and leaving harder to deal with inmates for the state or public entity to treat. What's probably more useful for us to know is that there have been a couple of studies of the studies. That is an examination of whether these comparative studies effectively answer the question they set out to answer. Does prison privatization save money? These studies, one which was conducted by the U.S. General Accounting Office and the other conducted on behalf of the National Institute of Corrections, generally reached the same conclusion, that the studies have not yet revealed whether or not there are savings to be had. The GAO report highlighted the difficulties that I've already mentioned in comparing the public and private facilities. And in their report, the GAO stated that even if similar private and public prisons are available for study, a comparison of operational costs can still present difficulties in ensuring that all costs, direct and indirect, are consistently and fully quantified. Possible difficulties can arise due in part to differences in the budgeting and accounting practices between and even within the public and private sectors. Determining the appropriate allocation of corporate headquarters overhead and government agency overhead, for instance, can be particularly difficult. Furthermore, comparing the quality of service at public and private prisons also presents challenges and, in fact, can be more difficult than comparing the costs, because the concept of quality is neither easily defined nor measured. Now, a consultant's report completed for the National Institute of Corrections pursuant to a congressional mandate reached similar conclusions regarding the issue of savings. Now, one conclusion in the NIC study that reported savings or costs are highly sensitive to assumptions made about public sector overhead and indirect costs, and again, the variable costs used to adjust for differences in inmate populations. While noting the difficulty of comparing private and public costs, one study reviewed in the NIC studies completed by the state of Tennessee should be noted due to a number of important statistics that were identified in the state's study. Among their findings, it was noted that private and public facilities that were in the Tennessee study generally spent the same on total wages. However, the private facilities generally spent less on overall labor costs, thus paying lower wages and benefits, but more on administrative costs. And as a result of these lower wages that were paid, one private facility in the study was reported to have a turnover rate of more than double of that of the public facility. And high turnover rates have been identified as a contributing factor of quality problems. Now, the issue of cost is often unavoidable in the debate concerning privatization. Indeed, a recent study survey by the Council of State Governments asked state officials their reasons for increased activity in privatization, and the most frequently cited answer was cost savings. But yet, when those participants were asked to quantify those cost savings, almost 2 out of 3 responding, that is 62%, stated they had saved less than 5%. Now, for a lot of government budgets, 5% may be a significant amount. However, there are several governments that require a minimum threshold of 5% savings in order to permit privatization to proceed. For example, Texas requires a minimum of 10% savings to allow private prison contracts. Florida requires 7%, and the District of Columbia requires a minimum of 5% savings. And the issue of cost has generally been a problem in all types of contracting out, as there have been many examples of cost overruns. They have occurred in many states and across many different kinds of services and with many contractors. One such example occurred in your neighbor, California, when the state contracted for an automated child support computer system. According to the news reports, the original price estimate more than tripled. 8 years and $99 million later, the contract was canceled by mutual agreement. And another example occurred in Texas, where the originally agreed-upon price for another consultant's contract for the computerization of child support reportedly skyrocketed during the course of the contract from $11.4 million to $77 million. But yet, it's one thing to talk about and debate the issue of whether there are any savings to be had in privatization of corrections. But in the context of privatization, the term of what you get, that you get what you pay for, is often applicable. In the discussion of youth offenders, you can't avoid a discussion about the quality that you're getting from private providers, because the lives of these youth could be forever scarred by their experiences in these facilities. And I'd like to share with you a couple of these quality problems. Perhaps the most notorious of alleged quality problems appeared in 1998, as documented in several news accounts of the Tallulah Correctional Center for Youth located in Louisiana. The allegations surrounding this privately run facility are no doubt among the worst of the worst privatization quality problems. The facility, which housed 620 boys and young men aged 11 through 20, suffered from serious problems as described by the New York Times. Inmates of the privately run prison regularly appear at the infirmary with black eyes, broken noses or jaws, or perforated eardrums from beatings by the poorly paid, poorly trained guards, or from fights with other boys. Meals are so meager that many boys lose weight. Clothing is so scarce that boys fight over shirts and shoes. Almost all teachers are uncertified. Instruction amounts to as little as an hour a day, and until recently there were no books. Up to a fourth of the inmates are mentally ill or retarded. but a psychiatrist visits only one day per week. There is no therapy. Emotionally disturbed boys who cannot follow guards' orders are locked in isolation cells for weeks at a time or have their sentences arbitrarily extended. Now, in fairness, I must report that three other publicly operated facilities in the state of Louisiana have also come under scrutiny. But there are many other instances of quality problems reported with privately operated facilities, some of which, unfortunately, illustrate some of the problems inherent in the privatization of corrections. And what happened with a private provider in Colorado provides an excellent case study of some of the problems that do arise. For example, even though at least three states were exercising oversight of its youth that were placed in this facility, and they had each documented significant quality problems with the private facility in question, it took 10 years for any significant action to be taken. In 1998, Colorado state officials closed the privately operated High Plains Youth Center after a 13-year-old committed suicide, which had followed a decade of reported problems. These problems ranged from reports of 23 alleged cases of child abuse in a time span of 15 months, to allegations that the facility was plagued by inept and insufficient staffing, insufficient training, high employee turnover, and inadequate treatment for kids suffering from emotional problems. In 1995, two other states which had also housed youth in that same facility had removed them, citing significant quality problems. In an interview, one official hinted at why it may have taken so long for his state to take action, a lack of alternative placement space for residents of the facility. Now, this is a common problem that we see in every type of contracting out of public services, where officials make a commitment to use a private vendor, and then when things go bad, the government doesn't have the capacity, the staff, or the space to quickly offer an alternative or to bring the service back in-house. Now, you might wonder what happened to the facility once the state of Colorado closed it. The owner simply sold it to another for-profit entity, which allegedly had no experience in housing juvenile offenders. And just last fall, reports surfaced that the same folks who operated the closed facility were regrouping to get back into the youth corrections business under another corporate name. Other documented quality problems from youth correction facilities include, in 1998, California and Arizona officials investigated the death of a 16-year-old boy in a privately operated boot camp where it was suspected that the youth had not received adequate medical care. Murder charges have since been brought against the former staff associated with that incident. Florida officials had canceled a contract after a riot in a youth detention facility had to be controlled by local police. And in the early 1990s, Maryland had numerous escapes from a youth detention facility when it was taken over by private operators. Now, again, in fairness, quality problems are not solely experienced by private operators of these facilities. But we would argue that the very nature of private facilities creates a greater risk and thus a greater chance for the very problems that these facilities have experienced simply because private operators must focus on the bottom line. Now, while we certainly have no problem with corporations focusing on the bottom line, our concern arises when the quality of public services provided by private entities suffers due to decisions made primarily to improve the bottom line. In the words of noted criminal law professor Ira Robbins of the American University Law School, questions concerning people's freedom should not be contracted out to the lowest bidder. In short, privatization is not a panacea. Several examples highlight this very issue of the impact of the profit motive on the quality of services provided. In 1998, the Pahokee Youth Development Center in Florida was alleged to have held 10 youths beyond their scheduled release date. According to a consultant's report, the youths were kept so they would be included in a quarterly headcount, which determined the amount of funding that the private operator would receive. Florida had also reportedly cited the facility for problems which included allegations of abuse, high staff turnover, and inadequate training for staff. And then in 1997, it was reported that South Carolina officials decided not to renew a contract for a privately operated juvenile detention facility amid allegations that the company mistreated some youths, including confining up to 20 youths in a cell that was designed to hold only four. And in Tallulah, the example that I reported earlier, the New York Times reported that the basic plan in operating the facility was to keep wages and services at a minimum while taking in as many inmates as possible. The New York Times further stated that for Tallulah to earn a profit has scrimped on money for education and mental health treatment in a state that already spends very little on those areas. Excuse me. Now, in closing, I would urge the members of the committee and this legislature to carefully consider the painful lessons already learned by other jurisdictions that have gambled with privatization of corrections. In the world of gambling, there is a saying, if you can't afford to lose, you can't afford to bet. The potential for cost overruns, the potential for problems that could permanently scar the lives of Oregon's youthful offenders would suggest that it is a gamble not worth taking. Thank you.
Ms., you indicated on page 2, you talked about some cases where there had been creaming by private providers. And I'm wondering how that would happen if you had a proper classification system for business. Can you explain that?
Some of the problems that were cited with the facility in Ohio, the Northeast Correctional Detention Center, you may have heard about the problems with the escapes that occurred there last summer. In the wake of a study that was done to determine what had happened, there were revelations that the inmates that were sent to this facility had not been properly classified, in that the facility was only supposed to be taking medium security inmates, and in fact, the District of Columbia had sent inmates that were not just medium security, but much higher security risks as well. And that indeed, the blame was placed on both the District of Columbia and the private operator in terms of the operator accepting the inmates too quickly and not having a chance to catch up with accurately documenting the security risk of each inmate that was taken in, but also the blame was put on the District of Columbia as well. That's just one instance off the top of my head.
Chair?
Yes, that's right.
Lisa, is it safe to say that creaming is somewhat the exception rather than the rule?
It would be hard to say because, frankly, a similar question could arise, you know, are there any positive stories to report from privatization? Because so often you hear about the problems. Now, you know, all we have are the allegations that we've heard and the reports that have come out. Should we assume that the private operators are cleaning on, in all instances? No, we shouldn't.
To your knowledge, do the youth facilities as well as the adult facilities privately ran have to adhere to ACA standards?
I'm sorry, which standards?
ACA.
ACA. As I understand it, the ACA is a voluntary accreditation for many private facilities. I believe that there may be some jurisdictions that require private operators to achieve ACA accreditation, but as I understand it, there are some public facilities that operate that do not have ACA accreditation.
Sure, if I may. So is it acceptable standards that a facility can house up to 20 individuals in a room designed for 4 without any kind of repercussions?
Well, I'm certainly no expert in the field of corrections, but I think it would be common sense that that is certainly not an acceptable standard.
Okay, even by credit.
Excuse me?
Even by private, it's not an acceptable.
No.
Thank you.
You led into one of my questions. Are there any success stories you're aware of on private prisons?
To be honest, this is the perverse world of a researcher, that bad news becomes good news for me because it makes my story easier to tell. And frankly, the news reports aren't interested in the success stories because the horror stories are really so much more dramatic.
We run into that in politics. Thank you. Other questions?
I do. I don't know if this is for Lisa or for Rich. It might be easier for Rich. I guess I've been struggling in my head in terms of looking at this issue, and I know that a portion of our youth, after they leave lockdown facilities, are in some type of secure residential housing that are basically managed by private providers. And it's how the system, I don't know, Rick's here, and he can probably tell me what the percentage is, but I assume it's a fairly good percentage. Why make the distinction between allowing private providers, essentially privatization, run non-secure, some of them are secure probably facilities, in communities, and not allowing private providers to run correctional facilities? What's the distinction to be made?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I actually think that the answer is in part of your question. There is a public interest in public safety, and the higher security cases you're dealing with or the higher risk cases of do tend to go to OYA, the juveniles with either runaway problems or a greater degree of violence or other factors that would make them higher risk. And I think the public interest is in making sure that that public safety is guaranteed, and that would lead to a higher degree of accountability being requested, making sure that the runaways do not occur, or not as, I mean, they aren't completely prevented, but they are at least inhibited a lot.
Okay, thanks.
Committee, we're going to get through this initial round of testimony, I hope, by 4:30, because I do want to get into Senate Bill 1247, especially since I note on the sign-up sheet we do have two people who have come from out of state to testify. So with that in mind, and I tell that to the other witnesses, I don't mean to cut you off, but you'll have another opportunity if you're not able to complete everything you want to say, or there's additional questions that it might not be today. Yeah. So, Rich, if you'd introduce your next two speakers.
Okay, they can introduce themselves. I think they're each less than 5 minutes of testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bryant and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ronald Thurst. I'm a mental health professional in crisis intervention unit at McLaren School. I've been at McLaren for about 14 years and been working with youth for 29 and a half years. I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to come before the committee. I presently provide mental health assessments for new arrivals, crisis management for those kids who are having problems on the campus, assistance with family crises such as death from a family, consultations with staff and youth in a number of cottages on special programs. My concern with SB 23 is that it would turn over the kind of work I do with youth to private contractors, and that the quality of service and treatment of the youth received would suffer. With private contractors hiring at a lower wage to increase profits, greater turnover, fewer training opportunities, and poorer facilities would result. Private contractors, I believe, would not be able to provide the in-depth treatment programs to enable changes in youth, because of the level of skill and the training to get through the youth is expensive to hire, private providers would be likely to cut corners in the hiring of such staff. These youth are often still open to change with proper guidance and treatment. Missing opportunities to change their lives at this stage would generally result in greater costs to the taxpayer, greater danger to the public, and wasted lives of youth. It is my concern that the use of private contractors could lead to warehousing our youth. In that approach, at best, they would be teaching the majority of them to become good inmates when they graduate to the adult system. At McLaren, approximately one-third of the 339 youth incarcerated there today are on psychotropic medications, and the other facilities have approximately the same percentage of emotional youth. Treatment for these youth is essential. As noted in some of the studies you've been hearing about today, when profits are priorities, these more costly services are often jeopardized. OIA has proven itself successful, and I believe in the it is important to keep our high level of treatment and even strive for higher standards. The proposals for privatizing youth corrections are unproven and risky, and there is no reason to be looking for alternatives to the current system. I ask the committee to reject the privatization of the youth facilities. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. Your testimony, please, sir.
Thank you, Vice Chairman Courtney and Chairman Bryant, members of the Senate. My name is Samson L. Ray Sampson. I work for the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm currently the local president for Oregon OYA, a member of OPEU. I've been at McLaren now for 12 years. I've worked with many youth that come through the facility. We have programs and training to deal with specific problems. One of the things that I'm kind of deviating from my written testimony here a little bit, going to make it a little short, getting nervous here talking before the group. I don't normally do this, so... One of the things that we do is that the administration insists on, we also, is that training. Our staff is very well trained on how to detect problems with the youth that come through the facility. We're constantly being trained and updated with new techniques and new programs. sometimes is that you will have youth come in that have specific problems such as drug and alcohol, drinking problems, or problem with the family, as Ron was saying. Sometimes we'll have youth that come in that gang members. We have a lot of gang members come through. Our staff is trained to recognize some of these problems that deal with the gang members and the attitude that they have towards each other, and to bring them back in line with the programs. A little bit on our programs that we have going at McLaren is that the programs kind of piggyback on each other. You'll have one program designed such as the violent offender, the sex offender, or general pop. These programs and the training of staff kind of piggyback on each other. What we do is that we have the facility and the ability to recognize certain problems, which we sometimes we get called on youth and to be put into different programs. We talk to different staff that we have a young man that's coming your way, a young woman that's coming your way, a specific problem. We deal with those problems by contacting the staff, the other program. It's kind of like the youth come into the program with these specific problems, and we bring them through to the program that they call to get out or go to foster care. Our big objective is that we, the staff, have a lot of interest and invested in these young men and women that come through. What we are concerned with is that we'd like to see them come through the system, and when they get out, they become productive citizens. That is our key, to make them productive citizens. Which brings me to another part of my testimony here is that last year, I had a young man call me from Washington. Well, it wasn't last year, it was about 3 years ago. He called me from Washington State. He called me on the phone. I was talking to him on the phone. I thought the young man was in trouble. What he had called me about in another staff there was to let us know is that he had now got married, he has a family, and he has a job, and he's not getting in trouble anymore. There was another young man here at Alberton in January. I was coming out of Alberton and Kaiser, and he yelled at Mr. Sampson. And I thought, uh-oh, what am I going to face here? It's either a confrontation or he wants to get on me about something. What he did, he's called me over to the car and he says, I want you to meet my wife and my new baby. So I go over and I says, shake hands and hold his baby. It's a nice looking baby. The guy's doing. I said, what are you doing now? He said, well, I'm employed now. He says, local, you see, I have to work for a local company. I won't tell you what he's at. But he's being productive. And one of the things he's saying is that I'm trying to pay back some of the things that you guys gave me. With privatization and the training that the staff have and the interest that we have in the young people that come through out there, we realize we're not going to save them all, but some we can save and some we do put a lot of effort into, is that with privatization, I don't see and I don't feel that you would have that dedication of staff that have the interest that in the young men to make them be productive citizens once they get out of the facility. Because it boils down to what we as staff out there see is that we have a lot of training, we spend a lot of money on training and programs out there, but our ultimate objective is to see that they're not either dead, get killed, or end up at the state penitentiary. So we're not going to save them all, but some we will, and that's our big concern. So I would encourage you, please do not vote yes on Senate Bill 23. Vote no. Thank you, sir. If there's any questions.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I have seven witnesses left. My orders are from the chair that at 4:30 I need to stop the hearing, so if anybody doesn't need to testify that I'm going to call out, we should let me know. Rick Hill, Kathy Osborne, Ron Wiggins, Diane Middle. There's four there. Kathy, you're going to please remember that we're now looking at 4:10. Rick Hill, Kathy Osborne, Ron Wiggins, Diane Middle. I'm tempted to put two more chairs up there and call two more people.
Mr. Chair,
I want Mary Botkin to come up here and Gary Schneider-Thunson. Now, I got to warn you, you come over from Monmouth. So you can come. Okay. All right. I'm just trying to accommodate what the chair told me, because we've got to get the other bill. We got two witnesses out. All right. Mary, are you coming up? Can you testify? What? Greg doesn't need to come up. How about Cam? Ernie from DOS? Where's Cam? He's coming. Okay, it's rock and roll, Rick. I don't want a PhD dissertation. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but you understand what I'm up against here. The chair will fire me and abuse and beat me up if I don't do right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rick Hill, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 23, and I will be brief. You have my written testimony, or you will have my written testimony in a moment. I won't repeat what's already been said, other than just to hit some highlights. There is not a lot of research demonstrating that the privatization of correctional facilities is necessarily a good idea. There's even less research on the juvenile end. Nationally, privatization has made inroads across the country. With some states, they've made little gains in the youth side of things. There have been some successes. Specifically in Colorado and Utah, there have been some dismal failures. Our mission, and we have tried very hard to keep it balanced, is one of public safety reformation and accountability. And we think that mission, that balance of that mission, would be threatened if profit were the motive for operating these facilities. We think the guardianship among youth offenders is much more complicated than it is with adult offenders. And when and if Oregon does go to the privatization style, I think it should not start with its juvenile facilities. Through its benchmark program, Oregon is recognized as a leader in the country in performance-based outcomes. The Youth Authority is participating in a national pilot funded by OJJDP to establish performance-based outcomes throughout our close custody system. Senate Bill 23 places no emphasis whatsoever on performance outcomes. We currently contract out for certain services. We contract out for certain programs. We are not opposed to contracting out. We have about $80 million of private programs operating around the state. They are operated by private nonprofit organizations. Some experts have questioned the wisdom and ethics of delegation in this area of governmental service to the private sector. The business arrangements of punishment for profit could potentially leverage the outcome of the debate around mandatory minimum sentencing and prison expansion. Senate Bill 23 introduces the concept of using firearms to control youth correctional facilities. Oregon does not do that. The public policy in Oregon has not condoned the use of firearms. This would also create a major training issue for BPSST, which is not budgeted for it. In summary, Mr. Chair, I think the best course that I could recommend to the legislature is for Oregon to wait a few more years to watch what happens in the other states that are experimenting with privatization in the juvenile field. There's a lot to learn yet to strike that balance between state control and privatization. I also want to mention Gary Lawhead is here, the superintendent of McLaren, and he attended a conference this year in Minnesota on privatization, so we are not turning away from it totally. We're learning more and more about it. So part of our position is based on the information Gary brought back from that conference.
Well, he's not signed up.
No, he's not.
So I don't want to be arbitrary because you're putting me on the spot, Rick. Thanks a lot. Kathy, a brief statement, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. As counsel informed the committee in this hearing on this bill started in December of 1997, my office organized a conference in which we brought out some folks from Associated Marine Institute. More appropriately, the Associated Marine Institute has several residential programs all over the United States, mostly in the South, and we brought out people from the Last Chance Ranch, which is officially known as the Florida Environmental Institute. That the reason for the conference was to show people in Oregon that there were other ways, more efficient, cost-effective ways to deal with serious violent juveniles other than Measure 11, and that there are ways to get to these youths and make significant changes in these youths rather than the need to incarcerate them for long periods of time. I think it's important.
Just one second. You're Mr. Williams, Ron. I just want to thank Ron. Ron's given up his time to speak, but he submitted written testimony. You all should have that. So I do want to thank you very much for coming here and scheduling. I thank you for coming here today, Ron. Thank you very much. Excuse me for interrupting, but I wanted to note that he did that.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
At the Last Chance Ranch, and I have a video about the Last Chance Ranch at my office. If the committee would like to see it. It is a very interesting program It's a program that I think Oregon should take a look at. However, it's important to note it is not a youth correctional institute. AMI does not run youth correctional institutes. And in the last conversation I had with Mark Carroll of Associated Marine Institutes, they refused to run any youth correctional institutes. So to put AMI in the group of privatization youth correctional institutions is, I think, misleading because their programs, although very good, are not correctional institutions. We are in opposition to Senate Bill 23. On the other side of, when you're looking at privatization, I have a very good friend in Louisiana who's currently suing the state of Louisiana because of the Tallulah Youth Correctional Facility. The problems with Tallulah that were outlined in Fox Butterfield's series in the New York Times is only the surface, is what I've been told, of the problems there. Additionally, what he tells me is there was a good 3 to 4 years of children advocates going to the state and going to the private provider, citing these problems and asking for changes to be made, and the changes were not made. I think on the other side of the coin, all we have to look at is how OYA responded to the youth suicide at Hillcrest. They were open to outside people coming in and taking a look at their facility. They were open to changes, and the changes have been remarkable. The changes that have been made at Hillcrest have been remarkable, and certainly the Juvenile Rights Project wants to praise Oregon Youth Authority for the way that they've handled that situation. I think it's that situation, and you know the praise the Juvenile Rights Project for OYA comes few and far between. But the fact of the matter is because they have dealt with that, and again and again we see private youth correctional facilities not dealing with those problems quickly and efficiently and letting outside people in, I think shows the major reason why we are opposed to Senate Bill 23. In addition, another major thing that we have is, again, the use of the weapons at the youth correctional facility. That would be a major change in Oregon. My understanding is they don't even use guns in the adult correctional facilities. So using them in a youth correctional facility would really get us very concerned, and I'm available for any questions.
Short statement, please, Mary. Knowing the clock, and I want to get to the gentleman next to you, please.
Short statement. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Bison with Action Council 75. For the record, we have long opposed the use of privatization as a policy in corrections, be it juvenile or adult. We represent folks who work with kids who are pre-adjudicated and after they have served their sentences. We have them at the front end and the back end. It is my, in my opinion, both the youth corrections program and the adult corrections program use private providers where it is appropriate for specialized programs. That is an appropriate way to use privates. It augments the needs that the institutions have and the programs have to provide, as I said, specialized services for kids and adults. And I have a handout I will give you all about problems in monitoring and ongoing monitoring in youth facilities. And I don't have anything more to say other than we just wish to offer our opposition to Senate Bill 23.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Cam Burney.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cam Burney. I administer the Transportation Purchasing Print Services Division, Department of Administrative Services. DAS has comments that focus upon three lines and three lines only in this bill. Actually, they're the last three lines in the bill, Section 14. Specifically, lines 33 and 34 say that the provisions of ORS Chapter 279 do not apply to the Oregon Youth Authority. This basically exempts Oregon Youth Authority from all purchasing law in the state for whatever services or supplies they wish to acquire, be they construction services, pens and pencils, or whatever. I suspect that there may have been an oversight in adding this to the particular bill. Indeed, one would hope that there would be some sort of a competition among interested vendors for such services. It wouldn't be, there would be a level playing field established, and the procedures of 279 apply. This also extends to fare for wages, wage and hour issues overseen by Bowley, and so on. That's my testimony in short form, Mr. Chair.
Questions, comments for these witnesses? Thank you very much for your testimony. We're a little ahead of schedule. Diane, come on up. Thank you very much for being willing to present concise verbal testimony. I appreciate that very, very much.
Thank you very much also, and I will be hopefully just as concise. My name is Diane Middle. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training here in Oregon. And as to Senate Bill 23, my concerns are directed, and my comments will be directed completely towards training and certification. My concern is that the way this bill is drafted, we are setting up some separate and different standards for the private facilities and those people that will serve as corrections officers, youth corrections officers in those facilities. It does establish just an oversight of training, which could imply a different standard. It does, beyond that, requires DPSST to then audit and review and in some way certify this training. This will require staff and people that we currently do not have. We do not have people expressly set aside to draft this kind of training or to monitor it or to review it. I cannot tell what the fiscal impact would be at this point in time, since it's unclear to me how many of these facilities there would be, how often they would be training, how often we would have to go out there and train. But on a policy matter, I just want to make absolutely sure that we as a state are clear about the proficiency that we want of our youth corrections officers and the oversight. I think that has been an area where we have had to learn a lot in the last few years, and we have reached a very high level now, and I think we should be very careful that we maintain that. My only comment, and I'm sure this would happen anyway, is that this goes to Ways and Means for further discussion of this particular area and the impact on our department.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. David, Lorian, please.
Thank you very much, Senator Courtney, members of the committee. My name is David Rivera, Salem resident for 30 years, currently working with Oregon Health Action Campaign, a program advocating medical services, primary medical services, and mental health services. The reason I'm against this privatization of Senate Bill 23 is that a human, number one, a human service program should not be turned into a business enterprise whereby the making of a buck would be the bottom line. Number two, it the way the program or OIA is already structured, it definitely addresses the issues of diversity for members of the different diverse communities in Oregon is adequately represented. And I think that if it were to be privatized, I think that asset, that strong program would be lost in the privatization of this correctional program. Again, the members that are already staff members of this program have lots years of experience in the areas of corrections, mental health. The third program, which you helped me draw up, number three, is that it's efficient, running smoothly, and in your words, it's a program that if it ain't broke, it should not be fixed. And again, I urge you to vote against Senate Bill 23. And thank you very much for your attention.
Questions, comments for these witnesses? Thank you very much, and I do want to go get on record thanking the witnesses for being concise in your statements. I'm sorry if you feel harried. We are at that time in the session where occasionally that happens, so I appreciate very much your accommodating our schedule. I now want to close the... Sure.
I just have to remind people that there aren't very many counselors or psychologists.
And then do all of their counseling for free. They actually do make a living by doing that. So, in a sense, there is a profit made in human service, in human services. So, we're fooling ourselves if we think that there aren't profits made in human services. That is, and I think that the people that go into those kinds of professions probably go in, maybe don't make as much as some other people can make, but the point is that they don't do it for free. Thank you.
Thank you, County Chief Scott. We'll not close the public hearing on Senate Bill 23 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1247. Marvin YB, I think it is, from the Cornell Corrections in Ventura, California. David Cook. And then I want Paul Rainey, please, to come forward. Yes? Okay. Yes, thank you, sir.
This is my bill, Mr.
Right.
Chair.
Okay.
And I'd like to say a few words.
Sure. Okay.
For these. They could please
come on up.
Come up and
come on up.
Say something, but I just want to say a few.
Can I just say the reason we wanted to move to them is these two are from out of the community, right. So we're trying to accommodate them. That's the reason.
I appreciate it, but
okay.
People
fine.
May not know at all what this is about. I just want to give you a brief introduction, and that is that the interim committee did study this privatization of adult corrections during the interim. I was influenced greatly by reports throughout the nation of private facilities that were actually doing a very good job. There are some issues that will be brought up about whether government should be giving this particular service away, and I would just say to you that we do not relinquish, as the public sector, our responsibility for the ethical and legal responsibility for proper treatment in prisons, even if we do privatize them. I believe that the accountability is greater in private prisons. Private prisons are monitored by independent government monitors, while government facilities police themselves. Inmates can appeal to monitor to the monitor over the head or of the warden, and private correctional officers are more accountable because they don't enjoy the limited immunity that civil servants do. Public officials have more control over private prisons than they do over their own facilities. The contract can actually tie payment of, to performance in very specific ways using both a stick and a carrot incentives that are not available with public employees. Best of all, public officials can manipulate the competitiveness of the market for contracts to get the best deal for the taxpayers and quality care for inmates from the private firm. Privatization does not mean jobs lost. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, on average, privatization leads to only 7% of employees being laid off. The majority of the employees are hired by the private contractor. And I just give that little brief introduction. I have many more statistics I could give you, and in fact, I will give to the members of the committee this report that came out in April of 1998, which cites there are 150 private prisons in the nation right now. This takes all of the states and studies the private prisons and how they are doing, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you find. And I believe there were a lot of private corporations that came during the interim and testified before our committee, and we had a work group working on this so that we wrote the legislation so we're not reinventing the wheel. There still may be corrections, and we're open for that, but I was just very pleasantly surprised to learn that private corporations do good. The public does better when private corporations are there just because it's competition. It's not that the private sector is so much better. It's just that it brings about some competition that improves those. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to say those two things. I didn't specifically talk to the sections of the bill, but we can read.
Thank you, Senator Chief. Marvin, really, would you like to go first? I notice you're from Ventura, California, and Cornell Corrections.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of this committee. My name is Marvin Weeby. I am Senior Vice President for Cornell Corrections, a private operator of correctional facilities for both juveniles and adults. 25 years ago, I left the ministry to find a better way to work with offenders and kids who I was working with in churches, but not very effectively. And I spent the last 25 years of my career with a number of companies, and I've been blessed in all 25 years being associated with people who cared about what we were trying to accomplish. And that's no less true these days as I work for Cornell Corrections, a company that lists as its first core value the belief that through caring, comprehensive programs providing dignity, hope, safety, and accountability, that people can change. And I challenge you today to begin with that thought in my testimony, that unless you have a conviction that people can change, including yourself, it's very difficult to get start every day and be challenged every day to make those changes you have to make and to deal with things in your life. In the same way we ask adults and juveniles in our correctional facilities, we ask them to make changes, and we are committed as a company to do that. I presented some material for your review. One thing I wish to bring right to your attention at the beginning is that our company produces what we call sort of white papers or position papers, and I put a couple of these in here. The first one is the value of treatment in prison. And I noticed that in the proposed legislation, there really isn't much analysis, although I've heard some reference today to perhaps looking at those issues, of what are the outcomes that happen in correctional facilities or in juvenile facilities for that matter, and what kind of outcomes are we looking for. And as a company, we're very much outcome-oriented. In fact, we believe that it's difficult to be really a value-added company and to be a value to government unless we can not only effectively deal with kids and adults and their problems and make a difference, but if we can actually make a difference in terms of people returning to prison. Roughly, people go to prison for about 2.5 years at a time, but if you really look at it, it's pretty much a life sentence on the installment plan. And we believe that there are ways to effectively address and make significant reductions in costs. And we would ask them to at least consider that in addition to looking at cost savings that private operators could provide and other reasons for looking at privatization, that you also give some consideration to a sincere and clear look at outcomes and to actually challenge both government and private operators to do a job that's really outcome-oriented. I gave testimony recently in California before a Senate committee, and the director of corrections, the acting director of corrections at that time, was asked the direct question, what are you doing to correct people within the Department of Corrections? And his response was that actually corrections is a misnomer, that they no longer do corrections. And when the senator asked the director, what is it you do? He said, we punish people. We are the Department of Punishment. There was somebody later on who commented that they were merely the Department of Guarding, not really even very effective at punishing people in terms of deterring them from coming back to prison. And so outcomes to us are a very important issue and something that need to be considered in this evaluation that is proposed in this legislation or in any consideration of whether going to a private operator makes any sense at all. I'd like to also comment that the issue of lower cost is obviously significant. I noticed in a recent study report that I saw that Oregon ranked 9th out of the 50 states in terms of percentage of your total budget dollars going to corrections in this state. And I think that any time you're in that high a league, that certainly cost has got to be an issue that's partly driving at least this discussion. And if cost is driving it, then certainly part of the solution needs to be a way to try to come to some reductions in cost. And while I agree with some of the presenters who spoke earlier that there needs to be a lot more work done, and I would like all of life's answers to be simple, but frankly they're not. I haven't found hardly any that are at this point in my life. And clearly the issues of doing an accurate study and really comparing costs and getting to the nuts and bolts are not easy. I've given you a copy of a report that was done by Adrian Moore of the Reason Public Policy Institute, and that's included in your material. He does a review, and relatively independent review, if anyone is truly independent in this world, a relatively independent review of about 14 studies that were done, 12 of which indicate savings of somewhere between 5 and 28%. He does address the GAO study that was done by the government and has some comments there as well. His conclusion at the end is that there are savings to be had in the public in the privatization of correctional facilities. But also, I think even he would recognize, and I've spent a lot of time talking to him, that there needs to be a lot more work done in this area, and I encourage anyone who's got the time and energy to do those things accurately and well to continue that effort, because I think it's of value, because we are spending a tremendous amount on corrections these days. So many of those dollars are being pulled out of other necessary budget sections, including education, and those kinds of expenditures cannot go on unchecked forever. And so privatization, I think, tries to be a sincere check and balance against those rising costs, and we see that as part of our mission. And so those materials are presented there for you to take a look at. With respect to the specific language in the legislation, I would like to at least note in Section 13, I think it's roughly lines 30 and below, there is some discussion there that talks about looking, if in fact this legislation would be passed, that it would need to give consideration to costs associated with construction and operation of facilities. I would also encourage you, and perhaps it's already in that language by intent, that you look at the cost of financing. Clearly, the ability of government to raise funds and capital to actually create new correctional facilities is a major problem in most states. Private operators are able to bring a certain acumen and resource and financing, and we think that that's a valuable benefit in some cases, perhaps not here, but in some cases it is, and we ask you at least to give consideration, both in your decision regarding the legislation and in the wording of this particular act. The other thing is that we would ask you, if this were to be a comprehensive study, and in the keeping with the earlier speakers who noted how complicated issues are, that you give at least significant consideration, not at least, but significant consideration to the issue of how legal issues are actually settled in government, how those costs associated with lawsuits, inmate lawsuits, lawsuits involving not just the settlements but also the legal defense costs can be actually given consideration. Because clearly that is part of what we have to do as private operators, and those costs are in our per diems when we give those to you. In addition, the issues of labor negotiations, workers' compensation, wrongful termination, sexual harassment, and those kinds of issues are frequently costs that both employers, both private and government, incurs. And they clearly are costs that we have to reflect in our numbers, and we encourage that any studies that be done also reflect those similar costs in terms of that specific language that's there. I'd like to kind of wrap up here with a general position in terms of what we are trying to achieve and kind of what drives us as private operators. When I speak of us, I really am referring mainly to myself, second to my company, and everyone else who will follow me. And that is that it seems to me that we have to be challenged every day, as I said earlier, to come out of the box doing the very best that we can. And some of the things that I've noted is that without competition, it's sort of difficult to do that. And we believe that competition, I certainly believe it very strongly. I've worked for not-for-profit companies, I've worked for for-profit companies, and regardless of whether it's a for-profit or non-profit, I am convinced that competition is really something that keeps me moving day in and day out, challenges me to do my job better, challenges me to look at everything in terms of the environment I am working in. I go out frequently and I have opportunity to talk with union people and talk in opposition to union people as they speak in opposition to the positions that I take. But I see that as a very positive part of my life because every day I am challenged by their comments to do a better job at what I do. And unfortunately, and not in all cases, but unfortunately in government settings, it is possible for people not to be terribly challenged. And the resources are not always used as well as they could be. And so if there's no other real meaning in my life's work, other, and in the work of my company, other than to be the gadfly that raises the issue and encourages even government to take a serious look at how we can do things more efficiently, how we can do things better, then clearly that, in that way, I think we are successful, and I am successful in my work because I believe in competition. I also believe, and with this I'll end, I also believe that we need to do more in corrections than our current policy, not just in treatment, but in terms of how we approach people. And I will give you this as a final thought. We challenge all of our staff. I don't care if they're a janitor or an account clerk or a driver who's just taking some inmate over to the local hospital. We challenge every one of our staff to be part of a team that has this philosophy. We believe that an inmate does not pay for his crime to society by doing time. I have inmates tell me that all the time. I've spent a lot of time with inmates in my life. And they will often tell me, I'm going to finish up my time here. When I finish it, I will have paid my debt to society. And we say to every one of those inmates, you are dead wrong about that. By doing your time, you have paid back nobody. You have not done anything for society. And until you acknowledge your guilt, until you begin to make amends through some way of restoring the victim that you hurt with your crime and the communities that you damaged, both financially and otherwise, You have not paid any debt to society, nor have you got really any right to go back to society and expect much from them. And I believe that until we get that kind of mentality, both with offenders and with the staff who work with them, and with the communities who are asked all the time to embrace a new prison coming to town, and to also take those same prisoners who by far greater numbers are showing up at the local bus stop every day as they release out of prison every 2.5 years, we are never going to get a system that really moves ahead until we embrace that philosophy at every level. And that's my challenge to you today. I think it's the challenge of privatization. I think it's the challenge of corrections, and whether it be a private or a public operation, we all should aspire to those levels. Any questions?
Can we hear from the panel before we open up the question? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Paul Rainey, and I'll be very brief indeed. I am here on behalf of John Raymond, who represents Wackanut Correctional Corporation, one of the leading private corrections institutions in the country, and I believe in the world. And my understanding is that there will be another opportunity for public comment on Monday at 4, is that correct? Neither Mr. Raymig nor any of the principals from Wackanut were able to make it today. I'm not sure whether they'll take an opportunity to testify in person at that time. But as for today, I'd simply like to submit a written statement from Mr. Coy Schuer, Vice President of Wackanut Corrections Corporation, commenting on this bill, and that'll be all for today.
Thank you. Dave. Have you testified?
No, I have not.
Okay.
I'm sorry, sir. I misunderstood what you said. I wasn't sure whether you said my name or something else.
Right. It's a weekday. I apologize for my voice.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I will thank Mr. Weeby for his comments as well. I believe that he would make an excellent employee of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I think they are, if he represents his company, he represents them well. And I believe that he speaks of the kind of issues that Oregon Department of Corrections speaks of daily. In addition to that, I'm sorry that Senator Courtney's not here. I appreciate his comments on the excellence of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I think he speaks accurately, and we try daily to represent those remarks. We've identified a number of major policy issues in Senate Bill 1247 for your consideration. I've submitted written testimony. It is my intention just to do the highlights, if I can do that, and take any questions that you have. Private providers are a legitimate option for consideration, and I think that that is really the policy discussion here. They have achieved success primarily in the construction area. That is something to be considered, but we believe there are major policy issues. Senator Acutub has addressed several of those. They continue to be policy issues because I don't think to this date that they've been addressed. The acting director in the state of California, I think, is speaking about the state of California. It's unfortunate that that state has grown so quickly and they have lost sight of the corrections efforts that have been made there, because they have, in fact, gone to, in their health care programs and programs of all types and in treatment, to essentially a non-system. And they may house individuals and they may punish them, but they certainly don't do corrections in the same way that Oregon does. Questions have been raised by the Oregon Department of Corrections and national experts not addressed in Senate Bill 1247. First is the operation of adult correctional facilities, and the fundamental question about whether or not a facility that incarcerates and detains individuals is so complex and inherently has so many issues relative to human and civil rights that only state government or local governments can, in fact, do that. And that's a question, I think, that needs to be asked and needs to be debated and ultimately answered by this body. An issue debated in other jurisdictions, is some of these notes I'm finding myself already addressing, so I'll pass through this, and again, we have provided the written testimony, which will highlight anything that I've missed. Secondly, what does the state want to accomplish in terms of privatization of adult correctional facilities? What are the specific goals? Some of those are addressed in the bill, but many may not be at this point. Contracts and rules for private providers should all focus on the stated goals. To date, these discussions have not occurred. Only stated goal identified in Senate Bill 1247 to date that we've identified is one of cost savings. Discussion of Senate Bill 1247 should focus on performance criteria, measurable outcomes, and benchmarks. These are essential to provide a basis for assessment and for the effectiveness of a private facility and Oregon Department of Corrections facilities. And Senator Bryant, as you mentioned earlier, the Department of Corrections is engaging now with a number of consultants and others who we have worked with in an effort to, as you and I talked about it yesterday, nobody to date has really done the kind of performance measures and outcome measures that, Oregon is seeking to address. And it may be that we begin that process and maybe we don't end it, but we certainly start the conversation. And most states are not at that level. They're at the level that Mr. Levy talked about in the state of California, which is punishment and detention. Some other areas of concern are performance criteria, standards, and benchmarks. The Oregon Department of Corrections is known for well-managed institutions, as Senator Courtney said, trained staff, programs that are effective, and innovative approaches that reduce the risk for future criminal behavior. Goals and expectations for Oregon Department of Corrections and private providers should be consistent to maintain overall performance of the correction system. For example, Oregon Department of Corrections has a major 17 compliance goal of 70% in the 1997 biennium, a goal that we will attain. The Oregon Department of Corrections has zero tolerance for illegal drugs in correctional facilities. This has been said before, I think you've heard it before, but the department ranks as the number one agency in the United States in terms of illicit drugs in the Oregon Department of Corrections. The national average currently is 9.3% random UA tests. In Oregon, it's less than 1%, less than 1% of that total of drug usage, and generally our figures are in the half to three-quarter percent range of illicit drugs through random analysis. Performance standards for correctional programs include GED completions by quarter and completion of training and treatment programs. Performance standards for institution operations include institutional security audits, something that was addressed earlier in the juvenile discussion, emergency preparedness exercises, custody classifications, records, sentence calculations, etc., issues that need to be addressed in the legislation and discussed before this body. These same performance measurements, standards, and benchmarks must be set for a private facility as well. The Correctional Privatization Commission, I want to take just a minute to talk about that. We are not in any way in favor of a commission model. We don't believe that that is the way to go in this state. There is to date, I believe, only one state that uses such a model, and that's the state of Florida. The commission is advisory and regulatory. It creates another governmental bureaucracy, in a sense, with similar powers and duties as the Oregon Department of Corrections. Commission authority overlaps the Oregon Department of Corrections. Some functions cannot be performed by a private provider. Those include sentence computation, assignment to the intensive management unit, transfer decisions, classification decisions, and a myriad of other decisions that cannot be done by a private provider. The private facility should be working, if in fact there is a private facility, it should be working in concert with the Oregon Department of Corrections, not in addition to the Oregon Department of Corrections. The ODOC recommends a contract management consultant to administer the contract with a private provider. We've tried to look for an analogy to this, and I'm not sure that we have one, but we see this in the sense as a real estate broker who in very complex transactions does business between the buyer and the seller to ensure that all parties' interests are met. And that's the kind of situation we believe needs to exist in Oregon if the best decision is made for the state, for the citizens, for the inmates, for the private provider, and others. In addition, a consultant will ensure completion of an impartial evaluation, which we think is essential, and continuous independent monitoring of the private provider. In a sense, a third-party evaluation needs to exist to ensure that the ODOC and the private provider are doing essential, or in fact, all of those requirements of the contract and the stated goals of the agreement. Cost comparisons. Section 13 of the legislation addressing cost comparisons should be simplified. The Secretary of State, we believe, should work with the Oregon Department of Corrections and the private provider to determine the net cost to the Oregon taxpayer of a private facility versus a comparable Oregon Department of Corrections facility. Recent studies point to several areas that need to be addressed to ensure accurate cost comparisons, such as assignment of overhead to the Oregon Department of Corrections, as well as ODOC functions and services occurring at the private facility. And there would be, potentially be a number of those. training standards and requirements. Ms. Middle testified earlier. The legislation, we believe, should mandate that the Department of Public Safety standards and training, certification training, and annual in-service training for a private facility be the standard. Profile of the inmate population. The private provider should be required, and I want to state this emphatically, should be required to accept any and all inmates currently housed in ODOC medium custody facilities. Senator Tarnow addressed earlier the issue of creaming off or whatever the case may be. There may be a number of ways to define that term. But the reality is, Senator, that it may occur in a number of ways. It may be that the private provider agrees in contract that the only types of inmates they will take are a particular classification with a current risk history, a past risk history, a placement on the sentencing grid. Any number of things could be the case. The other way, Senator, as you know, as a former sheriff, to manage that would simply be to ensure that those offenders that don't comply with the rules are quickly dealt with in an administrative fashion, put into a disciplinary unit, and ultimately moved on to RIMU or some other setting because they are disruptive in that facility. And there may be a number of ways to accomplish that. I don't believe that all the providers do that, but I think it is quite possible that the management of that offender base can be driven by a number of different strategies that wouldn't be addressed in the contract. The maintenance of records. The private provider must maintain same inmate data as the Oregon Department of Corrections. Inmate incarceration planning, which we do, Measure 17 reports that we do, compliance standards that we adhere to. The Oregon Department of Corrections would continue to be responsible for all inmate sentence calculations. The private provider's financial information and records should comply with standards established by statute and by rule. The private provider should be subject to Secretary of State audits. Not something I would want to wish on anybody, but we certainly do a lot of them. Facility siting. We believe the private provider, I'm having a hard time talking through private provider very many more times, but should be required to use a site already established for a men's medium custody facility. We don't see any reason to go back out in a siting process when there are sites available in the state of Oregon for this purpose, for men's medium custody facilities. Let me end with several conclusions. We believe you have heard policy issues regarding privatization and of prisons in previous legislative hearings. We believe the issues need to be debated, they need to be resolved, and clearly addressed in any legislation authorizing construction and or operation of a private provider in a prison in the state of Oregon. The legislature must determine which powers and duties the Oregon Department of Corrections could delegate to a private provider. We believe legislation must include the principles and the expectations to guide the process rather than delegating these responsibilities to a commission. And as Mr. Weeby ended, I would like to end in the same fashion, and that is to say that I think in the Oregon Department of Corrections, as has been recognized by Senator Courtney and others, there is a very strong ethic for competition. And I don't think that it's possible simply to say by adding, Senator, you and I may disagree on whether or not the addition of a private provider is the only form of competition that makes any difference, because I believe that currently you have 13 institutions in this state that compete on a daily basis to do the best quality work possible. They compete on programming. They compete on workforce compliance. They compete on the types of work crews they put out, on the lowest number of assaults on staff, whatever the case might be. They compete. The superintendents and the model that we've introduced in the last year and a half are under performance plans with specific objectives and benchmarks to ensure that the outcomes are there and that the work is there so that the inmate, when they leave that facility, has a fighting chance of being successful in the community. And finally, I think it's really clear, given the number of hearings and issues that have come up on privatization in the United States and in the state of Oregon over the last couple of years, so we not only compete internally, but we compete with adjacent states and with private providers, because you're not going to let us get away with continuing to operate a system that may be more costly and necessary. And finally, I want to speak to one of Mr. Weeby's comments. The cost of prison in the state of Oregon has increased. That's certainly true. But the reason that costs for prisons increase in this state and other states is driven by two variables: the number of inmates and the length of stay. It's as simple as that. The issues around, if you have a private provider who tells you that they're going to essentially be paying market wages, they have salary packages that are very, very similar, the only way to gain any efficiency and to reduce the cost of corrections is to incarcerate fewer individuals for shorter periods of time, and that will drive down the percentage of the budget that's devoted to the Department of Corrections.
When I opened the hearing today, I commented about the my purpose in being interested in the bill is not so much cost savings, but a comparison, especially as it relates to outcomes, because I'm not one that just wants people housed. I want the education, the drug and alcohol rehabilitation. I want to judge the performance based upon miserable outcomes so I can compare the two, and I think the comparison has an advantage. Mr. Levy, does that concern you? Do you think private prisons can meet those type of benchmarks? And I agree with Mr. Cook. Because of the way we keep records and the way things that are required, those are our requirements that would be imposed on private prison, too. Does that concern you, frighten you? Do you agree with that?
No. No, I think we need to meet every standard and expectation that states have as private operators. I don't have any problem with that at all. I think sometimes it's difficult to figure out there's a certain amount of regulation that some people see in privatization that is bypassed, I guess. And to some degree, people see, and just being as candid as can be, see privatization as a way to get around some of the bureaucracy that has slowed some states down. And I am not saying that Oregon has been slowed down in any way. I don't know the state of Oregon well enough to tell you that. I do know that we have been a company that has agreed to take on whatever contract requirements they are. And I frequently work with senators on legislation just like this, prior to when the legislation is actually put in, and give input on it. And it's never to eliminate some of the restrictions and controls and the requirements to meet standards that the government has to meet. I don't think that's a good idea at all, and we'll certainly live with those standards. As far as the issue of outcome and looking at what happens with people, our company already does this, and we don't do enough of that. Some of that may be our fault. Some of it's beyond our control. Figuring our contracts, we're not allowed to keep any of the identifiers that would allow us to do any kind of real tracking on inmate outcomes. We're not allowed to keep any Social Security numbers, like driver's license numbers, even the names. Even if we use under some kind of an alpha numbering system, our contracts frequently prohibit that. So our ability to actually find out what happens to offenders who come to our system is almost totally dependent on government to initiate that. And frankly, most government does not spend a lot of money looking at outcomes. And so it's a difficult problem for us. But where we do have some control, for example, we have a 300-bed community correctional facility through Dallas County Judicial Center, it's called. And in that particular contract, we have contracted with Dr. Dwayne Simpson at Texas Christian University, who's a well-known national researcher, has a long-term study going on of the outcomes on our particular offenders with very significantly more positive results than his typical control group so far after about 2 years of study. And personally, I think 2 years is way too short. I see a lot of studies of 6 months and a year, and after I stop laughing, I try to actually figure out a good answer. We have one group that we're working with, and sometimes on studies, you have to work by association. Sorry, Brian, I think you mentioned cognitive skills programs earlier. There's one cognitive skills program that we are using quite a bit out of a group called Correctional Counseling, Inc., who does a lot of outcome study work, and they actually have data on inmates going out about 8 years now or so, and they're looking at that. And as you know, if you go look at most research models, generally those two lines of the difference in recidivism, let's say, come together usually very quickly after a year or two. Their model has been running now for nearly 9 years, 8 or 9 years, and they're still seeing 25% to 30% reductions in recidivism over control groups, and their control group is a pretty rigorous group. And so we take that program and implement it in a variety of our correctional facilities, knowing that we're not going to have the benefit of the outcome data on that, but doing that nonetheless. Our juvenile operations, which represent about 40% of our business, and we do, by the way, run a juvenile detention facility for the Department or the Division of Youth Corrections in the state of Utah at a cost that's approximately $20 to $30 a day less than, and I don't have their exact number,
but even they acknowledge that we're $20 to $30 less a day than the state's former operation there. And we've been operating there for about 3 years. It's an outstanding program. But in our juvenile operations, we often are able to do outcome studies, and we do have some interesting data that comes out, for example, out of the state of Pennsylvania, where we have a lot of juvenile facilities, and we have ranked number one in the state for several years out there in terms of outcome with juvenile offenders, and we study that, and we outrank the state facilities and even other private operators, and we continue to try to improve our service. Does that mean we've got no warts and no problems? No. I know that I heard a lot of people today talk about some of those issues. Every company, I think, has some of those issues, and we continue to struggle through some of those and to continue to make improvement on it. But outcome studies are important to us, and to the degree that we can do more of them, we'd like that.
The question of how the way that the commission was envisioned to me was actually what you're saying an agent or broker would be. It would be that person, but it would be a commission. It would be more than just one person making the decision. And I thought a safer thing for the state than one person that is intermediary. And so how do you envision that commission being so much different than the one
agent? Mr. Chair, Senator Qtub, I think that in part our view of the commission is probably colored by the fact that there is only one commission existing in Florida. Several of us, and you may have as well, heard some of the statements made by both the Florida Department of Corrections personnel and the commission. I think in that state, what they have done is essentially set up, and again, this is happening from a 3,000-mile distance in a relatively short contact, but they set up what I think is an antagonistic environment. What we are proposing is more an environment that uses a independent third-party brokerage to negotiate the appropriate contract. And again, I want to congratulate Mr. Weedy for the work that he's doing on behalf of Cornell, because I think it's the first time I've heard a private provider really talk about outcome and performance measures and the health of the inmate upon their release. And I think that's going to cost something. Cornell's not going to do those things for free. They're going to do programming and treatment for a cost, just like, you know, not add an accoutrement to our car. And whether they can be more cost efficient than the Oregon Department of Corrections, I think it's debatable. But if we get into a situation where they are a private provider bidding for the services in the state of Oregon, that independent third party, I think, does the best job of ensuring that the measurement system is there, the evaluation system is there. And I think the commission potentially, and only again, Senator, because of the model that Florida has, runs all the risks of creating a whole new branch of, not a branch, but a whole new division in government that may or may not be beneficial, and certainly it's going to cost something, if for no other reason than to acquire the information, hire the executive director, do all of that. Those are costs that can be passed on to state government for other uses or reinvested for correctional programs or education or something else.
I think that one of the advantages might have been in Florida, though I do know the animosity with that commission, and it essentially happened because of, it could have been before even the commission was formed, and then they formed the commission because there was such fighting between the union and the department. The department really did not want to go private.
Right.
And so that, right. But Florida was able, I think, must be through this commission, able to keep some of the things that Mr. Weedy said you can't keep in tracking inmates, because they are the one state that has kept track of recidivism. And in Florida, the recidivism in private institutions is better. The rate is better than in public, 24% versus 17%. So that may be one of the uses that the commission actually functions as a governmental entity that can take this information and identifying things from an inmate and actually keep some statistics. But yeah, I'm not married to the idea. I do not want the animosity that's in Florida. You and I were both at a conference where they were there, and frankly, it was embarrassing to be in the audience and watch the fighting that went on there. And I don't want, I certainly wouldn't want that in Oregon. This was somebody, more than one person, to be responsible, to do all the writing and have all the responsibility for a contract.
And we would suggest, Senator, again, that that be a party that you contract with, so you don't have a full-time authority for that purpose.
Okay.
The other thing that I think that you all would say this probably more frequently than I would, but Oregon is unique because it's Oregon, and we're not going to normally approach these problems from a perspective of states that have tried something and may or may not work well without more examination. I think there are ways to take some of the suggestions, if and when this ever becomes law, and have a much more youthful process than what I think could be developed by replicating the Florida model. And that's just my bias around what I think we can do in a superior way to what they've done. The other way to look at this is, we already have a criminal justice commission. We have the ability to do a better job in this state to manage the information and the data that we have and the analysis of that data by beefing up those capacities. So, in fact, we're measuring the system. And I don't think we want to simply measure whether or not a correctional provider in the state of Oregon in a given situation of two institutions are doing better or worse than one another. We want to measure the improvement in the system by making fundamental changes to it.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Other Member.
Well, Madam Chair, I wonder how it is that short of an independent group to do an analysis on citizen, how valid those results are, and given, you know, that each agency can do their own analysis on the citizen, I still have some real questions about that issue.
About that particular statistic,
as a measure,
it is only measured in Florida, and I mean that's the only study that I know of. As far as private public.
Mr. Weeby may want to jump on this as well, but I do want to make a comment about this, and it goes back to our testimony. I think recidivism is a measurement, but it's a measurement that nobody can agree on who has responsibility for success or failure in recidivism. Everybody can take credit for it, and nobody can take credit for it, depending on how good it is, because it is a system response to whether or not people go back to a prison on rearrest. We believe, and we've tried to convey that in our written testimony, and I thought I conveyed it through the spoken testimony, there need to be other measures, other outcomes that are specific to the private provider or to the Department of Corrections in terms of the quality of work they've done around the outcomes of that particular inmate's return to the community. And get away from this kind of overall notion of whether recidivism is good or bad because of what variable you added to the whole pie of things that could be done to people.
That's why that is a way of measuring. If an inmate, presumably if an inmate has improved, they're not going to return. I mean, that is one way to measure. It may not be a perfect way, but...
Well, there's a whole,
and it's only one of the measurement tools. I certainly don't think it's the be-all and end-all, but we don't want people back in prison.
Absolutely not. But one of the things that I would say, Senator, is that there's an old adage about how to increase your recidivism. And the way to do that is to increase the quality and the numbers in your community corrections program to ensure that you have fewer clients on a caseload, to have more supervision given, because the other half of that adage, and the sheriff knows this, that the reality is that many of us put on a parole and probation program with all the conditions would find ourselves in a world of hurt many days trying to comply with all those conditions. It is a more difficult environment than most of us live under. And those kinds of things have nothing to do with how good the prison program is. It has a whole lot to do with how good the supervision has been or how intense it is.
Okay. Well, I don't know if you wanted to address that, Mr. Weeby, but it looks like, are we supposed to get through all these people this afternoon?
We have one member here. We can keep going.
Okay. Well, did you want to say anything, Mr. Weeby, before you go, about this whole issue?
Well, I think it's certainly worthy of a further discussion. I'm not sure I fully understand all the points that were being made, but I would make this observation, and that is that... it's easy for people to take, to lay claim to things that are maybe not directly attributable to their own work, and it's one of the things I think that is probably part of at least what we would like to focus on is a recognition that if we're really serious about doing the right things in the right ways, and I hear that Oregon is, one has to also recognize that there are lots of studies to show that if you target specific offenders who meet certain kinds of requirements and have certain kinds of backgrounds, that you can make a significant impact with your dollar invested in treatment. And generally speaking, states don't do a lot of that, but clearly there is really good evidence to suggest that there's stuff that can be done with people if you put the right people in the right settings and be more effective with your dollar. And then there's probably a ton more evidence. That evidence is that if once an offender leaves prison, that if we can have them in some kind of aftercare, so community correctional programs and other transitional programs, that the effectiveness of that treatment in prison is greatly enhanced. And, you know, there's only so much money to go around, but it's amazing to me that we have a lot of that, quote, technology and knowledge in our hands to make a pretty significant impact, and it's very difficult to get whole state systems to kind of work with that kind of a model. Would be the juvenile adult systems, but if we could, I think it would be very effective.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your testimony today, and we'll continue to look at the bill. Yeah, so thank you. I guess what we'll do, because...
How long is the first now?
Not very long.
Okay.
If we'll have cooperating... We are going to have more... testimony on this on Monday, but not a whole raft.
Chairman of the committee, we have a joint meeting with the House Judiciary Committee on an issue starting at 3, and that is administrative law issues, and then we start at 4 o'clock on this issue again.
Okay. So we would only have an hour next on Monday. So I guess...
And we have some people coming in from out of state.
Right, and so they would have preference. So why don't we have Diane Mill, Brian Blashman, David Laura? Okay. Then Mary Botkin, Cam Burney, and Greg Schneider.
An unlikely crime.
Ditto. Sorry, we let you testify during the intro.
Senator Tarno, I'm Diane Mill, the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and I'm going to focus my comments in one area only, and that has to do with the section of Senate Bill 1247 that talks about the training and certification of corrections officers. I'm very concerned that the way this is drafted, it sets up a different standard for the private and state correctional officers, and I would have to assume that as a state, our safety concerns are very much the same, both for the correctional officers serving in those facilities, as well as for the public should there be walkaways or escapes, and for the inmates themselves within those institutions. So I want to echo Dave Cook's comments that I do believe the certification and training should be identical. In the section of the Senate Bill 1247 where it talks about qualifications, it doesn't make any provisions for how a private entity is going to do the necessary background examinations and checks for these individuals that are required of corrections officers. That would lead me to assume that since DPSST must verify that qualification and certify it, that it would leave the department providing that service of doing the backgrounds on those individuals. We currently do not have personnel to provide that kind of a service. It also seems to imply that DPSST would be certifying these individuals as corrections officers and certifying that they had met the requisite training. Since that training would not be DPSST certified training, that would seem to require that we would have to develop a curriculum for a different entity
we would at a minimum need to provide the trainers or trainee trainers, and I would hope that they would be certified trainers to then conduct those skills. That would mean some oversight and some training also, again, which we do not have funding for. Also, as a part of our certification process, our instructors do test both academically and proficiency skills. Most of those proficiency skills are done through observations. Again, it seems to imply that Department of Public Safety Standards and Training would have an oversight and auditing provision. We currently do not have auditors that would go out and provide those kinds of services outside of our own staff and employees doing those trainings. So again, that would be an area that we would need to develop. As you probably know, DPSST since 1991, when it was still DPST and DPSST, each legislative session was given additional responsibilities and additional people that we were required to train. Unfortunately, our resources did not keep pace with all those additional responsibilities. This session in particular, we have reached a crunch where we cannot fulfill our mandated requirements with the facilities that we have or the funding that we have. Part of our budget for the next biennium requires in budget notes that we work with Department of Administrative Services and with others to find that additional funding and to develop those facilities. In order to bring on an additional project such as this, if this were to come on in the next biennium, we would have to take some of those development and startup costs from the current people and individuals that we are providing services for. And as I indicated, we are not meeting their current needs given our current budget. So I guess what the bottom line comment for me is that this is something that we would have to have some very serious discussions about the fiscal impact on the current services that we're providing. And then I realize the bill requires reimbursement, but there's still going to be some startup and development costs before we get to reimbursement, and that would need to come from somewhere. Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Association of Oregon Correctional Employees and also the Oregon Council of Police Association. I'll attempt to be really brief. Actually, my preference would have been to do this on Monday, but I'm told that there's limited time on Monday, too, so take your shot now. It may not surprise you that both of those organizations are in opposition to Senate Bill 1247, but what I'm presenting to you today is not a reiteration of all of the dialogue that happened during the interim, but instead a short section-by-section analysis of the bill in itself and what at least Gary Harkins, the president of the AOCE, saw as concerns about the actual crafting of this bill in its current form. So let me just highlight a couple of them. Sections 2-1, who owns the facility, obviously it's not specifically listed in here, but that's an issue that came up during the interim. Whether the state owns the facility and it's operated, you're well aware of all these issues being raised in the interim. This bill in itself may need to be developed to explore that particular language. Will a private provider be allowed to select which inmates are received? Again, you've talked about selection and so forth. This bill is silent on that, so we may need to explore that policy issue. You've heard about training under section number 6, section 7, training standards. Our position is basically the parallel position that Diane Middle has just given, that the standards for both need to be the same. We would suggest that that's the DPFST standard. Let's get down to the bottom, number 9, section 9, word substitutions. On the third page of the bill, line 29, we would strongly suggest that the may at the end of that, in the middle of that sentence, be changed to a shall. This relates to the ability for the state to gain access and find out what's going on in the institutions. The same language was my understanding in the standing contract between Johnstown, and that did in fact cause some problems. The access of the Ohio folks to that specific contract. And very briefly, Section 17, qualifications, who's supposed to be on the commission. Again, all of these are issues that need to be explored. With that, I'll kind of end my testimony, but I wanted to leave the existing members of the committee or remaining members of the committee with the thought that the AOCE came in today with obviously a position against the bill, but I specifically instructed the president to look at this bill and make specific suggestions out as to what are the policy decisions and what are the technical rewrites that would need to be done in this bill. And so with that, I'll answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Brian. Question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm one of the union types that whatever his name was from Cornell was, I'm sorry, I'm not being disrespectful, I can't remember his name.
Rainey.
Was referring to. I'm representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I know it's not any surprise to you, Madam Chair. We're in opposition to this bill. But we're actually going to be a little more specific because this bill has added some interesting kind of twists, and the previous speaker had also mentioned a number of things he wanted to be sure were included in the bill. We just happen to have a similar list. He wanted to be sure that they were covered for lawsuits and financing and liability issues and sexual harassment and wrongful discharge in labor negotiations. I think there's another side to this. We have, as a union, participated very heavily in partnership programs with our employers to provide for fair competition and open competition, in which our members also participate in the competitive bidding process, and we've been successful in several of our local government entities in successfully bidding for our own jobs. So I'd like to suggest a different kind of a list. We call this avoidable cost or unavoidable cost, however you want to look at it. We would like to see a portion of the governor's salary, the legislative expenses, the Department of Administrative Services, and the Attorney General, eliminated from the cost of corrections and overall costs and comparisons. We'd also like to add costs to the bidder for contract review and monitoring. Of course, we would expect to be charged the same amount. We'd like to address the span of control issues, administrative costs. We'd like to limit that to only those individuals who actually watch inmates. We want ongoing liability addressed, and we want to be sure that the contractor is, of course, held to the highest standard of the law, and that they are held accountable for any inmate lawsuits. And as you know, Madam Chair, inmates have an incredible amount of time to do nothing but file harassment lawsuits, and so we would like to make sure that the state is relieved of any possible liability when it comes to those lawsuits. We want to be sure that we do not have to deal with any of the inmate grievances, that we are relieved of all those liabilities, that inmate rights are handled appropriately, and that any wrongful death claims or lawsuits arising from any of the inmates' family members or associates would, of course, be handled through them. And we really are very concerned about the health care issues and about ongoing education and programs. What we found is that we are often, in some states, left with the sickest of the sick inmates, the most disruptive and the most disturbed. We would like to be sure that those costs are borne out equally and that we do not somehow inherit back the inmate who is suddenly old and sick and in desperate need of expensive and long-term medical care and treatment, which has happened in state after state after state. We want to be sure that everybody is monitored by the same outside agencies or the outside folks. I think that the Secretary of State should be given absolute unequivocal access at any time to any private facility as they are with our facilities. And then just finally, just in brief, this is some information I pulled off the internet last night, just kind of briefly outlining case after case after case of abuse and problems. In fact, the problems have gotten so bad with privatization in the prisons that Congress has just introduced a bill H.R. 979, which is the federal anti-privatization legislation, and the federal government say they're just not going to deal with private contractors anymore. They've had so many problems. So, I don't have any illusions that the bill will pass, but...
Will it be heard?
I don't even have any illusions about that, but, I think that it's interesting that they've introduced it, and... I actually think that it's very interesting that that's happened, and I think that the documentation from outside news sources is just unrefutable, that there have been just simply nothing but problems out there, and that state after state is going back and recapturing their inmates and recapturing their span of control in correctional facilities. So, but regardless, we're prepared to work with you as we always have been, Madam Chair, in the efforts to find a fuzzy middle.
Jim Bernie.
No, you
need to. Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Mary some questions before she gets out of here.
Mary, you need to stay up here because when you can't get through, Diane. What? Does anybody have any questions, Diane Middle?
I might make a couple of comments.
We're just going to change chairs.
Yeah, why don't you sit here? So you won't chill out in the end.
That's what happens when you give the gavel to the vice chair.
He's what?
A dictator.
I'm not dictating anything. I'm just
go
trying
ahead,
to.
Cam.
Cam,
right, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cam Burney. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services, Administrator of the Transportation Purchasing Print Services Division. This is with Senate Bill 23, where I asked the committee to consider deleting three lines of that bill. There's a similar request for delete three lines out of Senate Bill 1247. Page 5, Section 15, lines 14 to 16. Senator Qtub earlier mentioned that once a decision is made, if a decision is made to contract out, this brings out the competition, and there should be competition. The bill in itself doesn't necessarily say there shall be competition. I believe that by removing, I strongly urge you to consider putting a line, deleting those lines that I just mentioned, because they do say that Chapter 279, which is basically public agency contracting law, shall not apply to the situation. And in that public agency contracting law, there's a framework for competition. There are indeed avenues for very imaginative, innovative, alternative procurement that can be approved by contract review boards, including one within the state government, the director of DAS. So I urge that language to be deleted, and that's the end of my testimony.
Okay, now it's time for questions or comments for the witnesses, please. Did you have, yes?
Mr. Chair, Mary, you made a statement about something to the effect that states are going back to the old system or back to the state out there systems. Can you give us some data on that?
I can give you data on that, sir.
I appreciate that.
I will make it available to you.
Thank you.
Senator Qtub.
I want to comment, Mary, about all the horror stories in the private industry. There are horror stories in the public industry, too. And in all fairness, the privates get the notoriety, really, from shootings of inmates, gaming, and shooting of inmates. It took place in California in a public prison. Those were public employees that were shooting inmates. So, and that prison is not shut down. If it would have been a private prison, in a minute, it would have been, that contract would have been undone. That's the beauty, if there is one, of being able to do something about a facility or a particular corporation that isn't doing a good job. You can go in and revoke their contract because they are not meeting it. For those reasons, the contract would have to be written in such a way, and the phrase is not on the tip of my tongue, but at any rate, it could be resolved.
Mr. Chair, Senator Qtub, I would not excuse unprofessional behavior
anywhere.
And fortunately, I have never had to work in California, nor will I, hopefully, at my age, ever have to work in California. You know, they have brought us more problems than they have brought us solutions. And the good news is we've not had that problem in Oregon, nor do I expect that we will have. Thank you.
Getting close to Senator Lynn remark. Senator
Carl. This is one for Diane. Is it possible to ask Diane to make a couple phone calls to other states, your counterpart in Texas, perhaps, or Pennsylvania, or other states that are in private institutions operating within those states about how they certify? How about training programs for the private institutions? Can you get information back to us?
I'd be glad to try and get that information.
And Mr. Chair, the reason I wanted to keep Diane up here is because I would like to work with you on how we could do this. We put these things in the bill primarily, as you said, it does say reimbursement. I don't see that the requirements would be all that different, and therefore there shouldn't be any huge startup cost. But I would like to work with you on that, and I'd like to see the results of those phone calls too.
Okay.
Although I'm sure we addressed it during the interim. I do not quite remember what other states were doing about training. So, do you, Bill?
Chairman of the committee, I don't. I think it was one of those issues that was in development at the time.
Okay.
And I do remember when we put this together, and it was to try to make it parallel, not identical,
right,
because of the concerns that you could never be identical.
Right.
Similar.
Right.
Anything further? Thank you very much. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Close
Chair.
The public hearing on Senate Bill 1247, and the Judiciary Committee is adjourned.
You guys, I said I was going to give you a copy of the study, that Reason Foundation study. Cornell has provided it in their information.
I had a half of file cabinet.
Okay. Well, maybe.